Boy, oh boy, do we have a very, very special episode in store for you today. It is not often, actually not ever, have we had this yet. So we're very thrilled to have this episode of the Lone Star Capital podcast with, of course, the founder of the firm, Rob Beardsley, but the other founder of the firm, Kent Petrakowski. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Well, this has been long anticipated. Did you have something to say? I looked like I cut you off right there.
I was just saying, we finally have dispelled the myths that there's this mysterious other partner that doesn't actually exist.
Right. Well, and for those who are wondering, yes, there is a member of the team with some gray hairs, and here we are today. So, with that said, let's just dive right into it. Would you mind just providing us a little bit of a background to yourself prior to starting Lone Star Capital from a work perspective?
So we came from very different backgrounds when we started a multifamily. Multifamily attracts a lot of different types of people. We were on our respective journeys. But what I think is very unique in the way that even though that we had very different journeys and backgrounds, we came together in such a complementary way. So what do you think it was that you were able to identify at that early stage of not even Lone Star existing that, number one, you had the idea for an entrepreneurial pursuit, and number two, you felt like a partnership with someone like me would be a good idea.
I was always looking to, I'll get into my career later, I guess, but I was always looking to do something entrepreneurial, exploring various paths, false starts over the years, kind of moonlighting during my career. Did try my hand at real estate back in 06, which is the perfect time not to jump into it, learn some valuable lessons there. But, so from my start of my career back in 2006 until I ultimately left in 2018, I was keeping my eyes open on some ways to break out and do something outside of a 9-to-5. When I started looking seriously back into real estate with, a new mindset, it was probably, I'm trying to remember if it was mid-2016 or 2017, somewhere right around there, kind of dug into bigger pockets, went down the whole rabbit hole, really, started listening to the podcast on multifamily syndication. And that kind of really spoke to me as, we haven't spoken about my background, but as an attorney, was comfortable with the structures. I had experience reviewing those things on behalf of some of, my jobs. And when we met, I still had my day job, right, as you know, and kind of felt like I was making some traction, but definitely needed someone to partner up with. There was no way I was going to be able to do it all myself. And I kind of identified a need for someone to kind of take the lead on the underwriting side of things.
Right. And obviously, at that time, I was kind of making myself in that regard, right? That was kind of my focus, and that's where I was cutting my teeth and really actually enjoyed myself most was underwriting deals. And, for better or worse, I don't really do any underwriting now, just really kind of oversee the process. But it's a really interesting because just thinking back to those times and from what you just said, it sounds like it was for both of us perhaps kind of like a partnership of convenience at first, where it's like, well, we just need you needed help and I needed someone to tell me I'm not crazy and that I can like do this with, right? Because originally I wanted to do it with my parents, but we became so much more than just a partnership of convenience, right? We just have such complementary skill sets, and that we couldn't have really known, but we got really lucky in that regard. So when people say, "Oh my gosh, how'd you meet your business partner?" and "Oh, you met him at a conference," should I do that? Should I drop out of college and start a company with my business partner, right? And I tell people mostly no, right? I tell mostly we just got really lucky, and we didn't just vet each other to the max and really put together this amazing business plan that we were going to march forward on.
That's true. I certainly, it's kind of surreal to think about how we initially met and how it's worked out, 6 years later. But I did go to that conference with the mindset of trying to see if I could find someone to partner up with, bizarrely enough. Joe Fairless, who we were, whose mentorship we were program we were both in, had posted a video, and I think he might have shared it before the Best Ever conference, which was where we met at his conference, recommending not trying to just hand your business card out to every person at a conference, but focus on one person a day. So I had that in mind. I was like, okay, let me follow that advice. And while it was sort of a partnership of convenience at first, there was more synergies there than just that. We were both looking at similar markets. We had both looked at some of the same deals. And we had, yeah, complementary skill sets, and we've seen that over the years, but it worked out as well as it could have. But there's no way we could have planned that, or, you know, there's no way I could have expected to have find that.
I have to ask a hard-hitting question here. How did you feel comfortable with a 21-year-old Rob Beardsley who was at college when you were Kent with a family, with wife and kids, to, you know, have this bold idea of starting to buy real estate with a younger gentleman when you had a lot more, you know, on the table? You had, you know, real life bills and stuff, and you were just, you know, it didn't matter because you could fail 8 times as long as you get back up 9, right?
Well, first of all, we didn't start Lone Star right away. We just decided to, you know, play the field a little bit, look at some opportunities together, see if there might be a deal we could find. And we were fortunate that we found the deal so quickly. I mean, we met originally, February was the conference. I think we signed the contract possibly in April or May. We certainly had the deal awarded in April. I don't remember when we signed the contract. So getting something under contract so quickly definitely helped solidify things. And then we got to know each other during that experience. So, you know, Rob's usually on camera, and there's a reason I'm not. But early on, you know, I was able to recognize that Rob did a very good job presenting himself. And that was a skill that, you know, while I was looking for underwriting, that was also a skill that, you know, wasn't one of my strengths. So we were able to lead into that as well. So it just naturally evolved as we got into that first deal and worked from there.
Interesting. And then a question that I have, actually, it sparks this, is on your end underwriting, right? Is that something you felt like that was most in your control because it was numbers and you were really good at numbers and that was what you're going to dive into and lean into most?
For me, I'm a numbers guy, and coming from always working on spreadsheets and then going to school for computer science and focusing on that type of thing, the number side of real estate resonates with me much more so than the qualitative stuff, which is really important. And that's something that I work on. But the qualitative stuff is things like the growth story and the job story and, you know, who lives there and what's going on around it, right? Like that stuff, I kind of, my eyes glaze over when I start to think about that stuff. But if I can crunch numbers and just see it all cleanly, I can make sense of it more. So yeah, that's where I gravitated to first. And as far as the business goes, in my mind, I thought, okay, well, underwriting, the financial analysis of these investments, you know, underpins the whole business. So if I can understand this, I can be successful.
Yeah, I mean, I could just imagine you, knowing you, practically speaking, well, you know, numbers obviously don't lie. Numbers are true. So I'm going to focus deeply on that because logically speaking, that makes sense to you. And also, you know, there's no ageism in numbers, just numbers are numbers.
Well, that's why I published, that's why I wrote the first book that I did, which was about underwriting, right? Because you don't necessarily have to have a 50-year career and a big gray beard to teach people your process to underwrite. I didn't buy 100 deals at that point, but I'd certainly underwritten hundreds of deals at that point.
Yeah, with that said, how did you both arrive at Texas as a good market to pursue deals in? You know, because considering the fact that you're from the Bay Area and then you're from, you know, Brooklyn, I believe. So how did, you know, Texas, the middle of the country, did you guys get there?
Yeah, I'll answer that in a second. But just going back to the underwriting and how I got comfortable partnering up with Rob at that age, I was looking for a model that I was comfortable working with. And, you know, there were some online, there were some that I paid for, and I still hadn't found one that I felt was what I was looking for. And then I met your dad first, and he's like, well, you should meet my son. My son created this model. So he, you know, introduced us there, and, you know, looking through the model, it was, you know, definitely qualitatively better than the stuff that I was previously working with.
Interesting. And then back to the marketplace, how did you both independently arrive at Texas as a place you wanted to pursue deals, considering you're from the Bay Area and you're from New York?
Yeah, so my on-ramp into multifamily syndication was through Joe Fairless's mentorship program, and he provided us the opportunity to raise for some of his deals. So my first deal was a deal in Fort Worth. So that got me exposure and familiarity with the Texas market. From there, I got introduced to someone who's doing a deal in Houston. So I started researching that market a little bit more and found slightly higher cap rates, slightly better cash flows. So, just lean in that way. Obviously, the Texas growth story is no secret. All the job growth, the population growth, that was all well known. But how, I specifically ended up there was, through the network that I was in.
Yeah, interesting. And seemingly, in Kent fashion, you saw around the corner, and the tailwinds for Texas as a state has obviously been great, considering, it was more open during COVID and whatnot, which, obviously really sparked a lot of the growth and a lot of, still net new migration to the state and over the last couple of years, which has obviously been a very solid linchpin to our success as a firm. But I'd be very curious to know, back to kind of your background, when you were sitting, doing, your tax attorney job at MetLife and whatnot, did you kind of always know there was something entrepreneurial deep down in you that you weren't kind of itching and scratching? Like, did you think you were always going to be kind of your own boss at some point?
I always hoped so. I think you're a big fan of Rich Dad, Poor Dad. I read that before I bought my real estate first four unit property in Pennsylvania back in 2006. I had read Rich Dad, Poor Dad, discussed it with, a friend of mine we ended up partnering on. So I was always interested in, new ventures, new ideas. Just intellectual curiosity perspective, just enjoyed reading about that kind of stuff. And then over the years started thinking about, find a way to make that happen. So it was always an interest of mine. And then over the years it became more of something that I tried to find a way to pursue. Having a mortgage and kids and a day job, it is harder to get that exit ramp, but thankfully, things worked out.
Interesting. Yeah. And I'd be curious to know, do you have any other, before going head deep, of course, into Lone Star deals, and you mentioned the Fort Worth deal, but were you kind of periodically investing throughout in other multifamily projects that kind of, slowly showed you, the value creation and the upside at a smaller scale before getting to 100 plus unit opportunities?
I did not have a whole lot to invest, so I was not able to do that. I did have the opportunity to review some offerings. One of the angles I explored before settling on a multifamily was just financial planning. I've always, setting yourself up well, kind of like your father does, just understanding overall, from a holistic point of view, someone's personal financial statement and making sure they're prepared for success over the long run. So I always found that interesting as well. And so I had some friends send me opportunities that they were looking at. So I had some exposure to those opportunities. I wasn't in position, unfortunately, to take advantage of some of those. And those were some really nice years to invest in those. But no, I was not in position to invest before that.
Right. Well, then speaking of, before you started Lone Star Capital, do you mind diving into what you were doing prior to Lone Star?
Yeah, so I'll back up a little bit. I was an attorney, so I went to NYU Law and specialized in tax, got my LLM there, started my career at PwC, PricewaterhouseCoopers. I was in the M&A tax group, mergers and acquisitions, for a couple of years, mostly doing due diligence for private equity firms on their target entities. Then moved over in-house to MetLife. So I was there for 10 years in various roles. Some touched on some real estate related legal work there, tax legal work there, including a large hotel acquisition MetLife participated in. So, but mostly it was pure, corporate tax work.
So something that I thought was interesting is when we first started doing deals, I would say my business partner is a tax attorney. And people would say, oh, well, that's so great. And that must be so helpful. You save money on your legal bills, right? And I laugh because, you know, we still obviously use all the appropriate outside counsel, right? We've got an attorney to do PSA, financing, partnership agreements, securities attorneys, right? It's not like you're doing all that stuff yourself. So I kind of brushed it off. But then as time has gone by, we've just seen time after time how valuable your expertise and the way that you are able to understand things and look at things just be so helpful. So I think it'd be interesting to dive in a lot onto some of the things that people don't think about when they think about real estate, because on the surface, it might seem like a simple business. You just buy apartments, they cash flow, you pay the investors, right? But there's so much that goes on, brain damage, if you will, to get these transactions across the finish line. So, so many directions you can take it, but what are some of the things that you feel like, maybe you don't even notice it because it's easy for you, but what are some things that you go, oh yeah, that's nice that I have this skill set when you're kind of maneuvering through things?
Like you said, we're not saving on legal fees because, I mean, one of the goals of leaving law was to become the client and not the attorney. That said, having the legal background is certainly very helpful. Being able to speak with our attorneys intelligently about the contracts, understanding what the likely issues are. We're looking at a deal right now where we're buying a REIT, and definitely leans into my tax background experience specifically. I mean, I don't have a real estate background. Like I said, I had some tax related, I had looked at some of MetLife's real estate deals from a tax perspective, but I never reviewed, a title report before. I don't have that real estate law background to lean on that's directly transferable to what we're doing on a day-to-day basis. But understanding the fund structures, understanding the nuances in a REIT acquisition or some of the affordable stuff we're doing, just having that training and education certainly allows me to understand some of these issues a little bit quicker. I think the other side of it is just, soliciting someone's confidence with having that background.
It's true. Well, let's dive in more into the REIT right now, because that's top of mind and something that's very cool and unique. We're buying a deal that is structured as a private REIT, and it was pitched to us as something not that complicated by the broker. The broker is like, hey, just by the way, this deal is owned in a baby REIT. Can you handle that? And we figured, oh, sure, why not? But the reality of it was and is complicated, and it is costly. And the previous buyer fell out of contract or wasn't able to get the contract signed because of all the nuances associated. So do you want to just share the process that we went through for just understanding what the situation was and seeing it from fresh eyes, because obviously we haven't done it before? What was our process for figuring out what we don't know? Which there was another situation where you were helpful because you were able to leverage your network and call upon a friend at another law firm and say, hey, do you know anyone who specializes in this structure? And we were able to pretty get to the bottom of it quickly. So you want to just kind of walk through that process?
I think you kind of touched on it. Just having, knowing who to call was definitely gave us a head start. Understanding the issues, at least at a high level, allowed me to, it's kind of more of the same. Being able to speak intelligently with the tax attorney. The attorney we're working with is actually at a firm that I had interviewed with when I was in law school. Did not get the offer there, but it's fun to be working with them, this many years later. But, having him understand that I have this background, so he's explaining things to me at a different level than he might explain it to someone who doesn't have that experience. So we were just able to move a lot quicker and, can probably, I could, together with our counsel can come to a conclusion on what the risks are, and we're not just relying on the outside advisor's advice, but I can weigh in myself.
I think therein lies the problem often is perhaps some people let legal drive the business decisions, right? But you're able to speak the legal, understand it, and then synthesize it down to where you and I are just understanding, okay, here are the risks, here's what legal is saying, but what's our business decision? So for example, on the REIT, we're looking at the indemnity, right? So what is an indemnity in this situation? Did we need it? Is it worth it? Like, what are some of the thought processes and things that we were able to make heads or tails of?
Yeah. So, I mean, and it might be helpful just to, I guess, get a little bit more and then into the details here. We're buying a REIT. A REIT is a real estate investment trust. It's a, you know, there are public REITs traded on the stock exchange, but essentially it's a vehicle where real estate is owned in a corporation. But if you satisfy certain requirements, you can distribute most of the income up to the investors without having to pay a corporate level tax. You know, we're usually not structuring anything in a REIT format where we just have partnerships and we only have one level of tax that way. In this particular situation, the primary investor was a foreign entity, and for reasons I'm not going to get into, it was favorable for them to structure it as a REIT. We don't want to own this asset as a REIT. So we're buying the shares of the REIT and then immediately unwinding it. So we need to get comfortable that the seller properly complied with all the requirements to maintain its REIT status, and that there is no, you know, failure in that regard that would warrant a potential corporate level tax.
Meaning that we would assume by buying the REIT entity.
Exactly, because we're buying the entity itself, we inherit, you know, any liabilities related to that, which gets to the warranty. So a warranty helps limit that to the, you know, degree of the policy. We can protect for potential exposure there. So, you know, with our advisor, we're able to quantify kind of what the potential exposure, the tax exposure is on that acquisition, and get comfortable that we have, you know, identified what the universe of exposures are and that we have the right policies to protect us in case there is a liability at the end of the day.
So real quick, I mean, we've been telling this story to investors a lot and having these conversations. They're asking, well, what is the situation? What's the REIT? What are the cons? What are the pros of buying a REIT, right? And there's really no pros, I would say. What I tell them, though, is the pro is the buyer pool was limited by this structure. So I think maybe in the words of Sam Zell or someone else who's very smart, we buy complexity and sell simplicity. So in this case, we're going through the upfront work and risk of buying the REIT structure, but then we unwind the REIT to go to fee simple ownership a day later. And then when we sell the property on the back end, we're selling a fee simple asset with no complications. So am I explaining that right to investors? Am I missing something that I should be telling them as far as the pros and cons?
I'm kind of hearing just at a high level is working with Lone Star Capital, with the nuances that we have to go through in the business that we're in, we can absorb information cheaper due to your acumen and quicker due to your acumen, which is amazing for investors because we get structures and upside to deals that most people cannot navigate, at least at an efficient enough level with an ever fast moving market.
Perhaps that's true to a degree. I mean, I don't want to oversell it, but yeah, I think we've been willing to wade into complexity a lot more than perhaps, you know, we've suffered a lot of brain damage with the result.
Or gluttons for pain.
Exactly. Perhaps my experience makes it easier for me to, you know, for us to want to go that route. But I think it's paid dividends. We've navigated, you know, through some of the affordable structures, this restructure. So, you know, continuing to level up, continuing to go through these iterations, you know, it'll allow us to do another REIT deal. And, you know, we're already seeing potentially another opportunity to buy another REIT. And we can now say we've done it or we're close to having done it. So it definitely pays dividends over time.
Yeah. Any broker around town who's selling a deal in a private REIT structure with a foreign entity, perhaps, right? They're going to know who to call. So that's compelling. And we'll definitely dive into the affordable stuff that you've been alluding to, which is very complex stuff and has really, you know, all the credit it rests with you on that, which is very fascinating. But yeah, all these things are great builders of our resume as far as buyers. When we bought our first deal, we didn't have a resume. How could the seller trust us, right? The only thing that we could really do was we could get on the phone with them, talk a big game, and put up a big hard deposit, right? And which is, it's fine. That's how everyone has to start. But we built it up brick by brick and deal by deal. And now the resume is, okay, well, we bought X amount of deals, doing a private REIT. And if we're perhaps bidding on a deal that has an affordable component to it, right, they also similarly know who to call given our experience of doing at this point now 10 deals with an affordable structure partnership thing. So those are all exciting things. And like Craig was saying, it speaks to our willingness, first and foremost, and then our ability to back up our willingness to wade into complexity and create value for investors. And I think that goes above and beyond just us wanting to make money for our investors and make money for ourselves. I think we just have a inherent desire to do kind of unique things and not strain ourselves, but you know, you and I like things that are a little more complicated, if you will. I don't know, I'm trying to describe it better.
Like puzzles. Well, you guys like to solve, you guys both, I know Rob very well this, you like to solve things. It doesn't matter if it's I get a computer and you geek out about, and this is so silly, but your brain works a certain way where if you get a computer, you're more excited for me that I'm at the computer because you're excited that you get to download everything, program it, set it up how you'd like to do it, and start from scratch and build things. I think knowing you as long as I have, one thing that I think your form of art is creating businesses and products and, you know, vision, right? So I think similar to you, I think what I can gather from my insights of knowing you is you like to make really complicated things be very simple. So I think you have that unique skill set and ability to digest and comprehend things very, very smoothly and efficiently. And that's probably due to your law acumen to a certain extent. I would imagine, I'm guessing, I'm going to ask you, you know, I would assume, but I guess I'm going to ask, are you actually a certified speed reader? Because you could probably churn through information substantially quicker than the average individual.
I don't think I'm a certified speed reader. I have tried to really learn to speed read at times. I think I read pretty quick, but I couldn't even tell you how many words per minute.
Yeah, it's lawyers are crazy though. It's like, oh, they just emailed me the contract and it's however many pages, and now I read through it already and marked it up and whatnot. I mean, it's pretty cool.
Yeah, but it, you know, part of it is just knowing what to look for, seeing it many times. You know, you could zero in on the aspects that are most critical.
It's funny. I might see something like that and freeze up and, like, you know, automatically reject some really long looking legal document versus you might look at that and you might salivate a little bit and get excited to churn through some of that information because you could sift through that with, you know, speed and knowing with certainty what you're supposed to look for. So that is very valuable in itself.
I don't know that I ever loved going through it, but now it's easier knowing that I have usually, you know, someone else to backstop it.
Right.
So I could focus on, you know, the salient points or the key business points, but, you know, can go through it with and looking at exactly what I think is most relevant, knowing that, you know, our outside counsel will look through it again and catch the stuff I glossed over.
Also, just one thing that popped into my head about the REIT is the first turn of the contract, they wanted us to maintain the REIT structure throughout the entire calendar year. And, you know, for various reasons, we didn't find that to be attractive. But if we didn't know any better, or if we didn't have the right counsel on our side, we would have either swallowed those terms or would have walked away from the deal. So I think that's another element of, you know, when you and I bump into roadblocks or no's, we don't take a no for an answer. I mean, we're not rude or anything, but we definitely don't just stop at the first speed bump. We just keep pushing, and we find a solution.
Yeah, I think we're both stubborn that way. We both do like solving puzzles. I know I do. So yeah, I think that's one of our strengths is the ability to work through issues and find a path that works.
So speaking of which, let's talk about some affordable stuff. And let's get into it. You know, we don't have to cover everything, but I'd just be curious to know, after everything we've been through and all the hard work you've put in, and as far as discovering different structures, hitting dead ends, building relationships, you know, do you want to just give an overview of your journey, if you will, on that front, or kind of what has been the most interesting and exciting things about that complex part of our business?
You know, we were introduced to some of these affordable ideas way before interest rates were looking likely to increase. You know, I think it was probably even in 2020, that I first heard about some of these structures in Texas and got acclimated and had some conversations with the attorneys. But it took a long time to build those relationships up. And I was intrigued by it just, you know, at the outset, just simply because it seemed like you know, it would make sense for our investors. It would be definitely value add. We were looking at it on some of our earlier deals potentially. You know, we didn't really find the path forward for a while. Shifting gears for a second, we've talked about how some investors can take years to build those relationships and they pay dividends only later on. You know, you can meet someone, you gave a course on underwriting, you know, and then, you know, years later, it'll come back to benefit us in a huge way. So this is one of those things where we're putting in the time up front.
It was a wild goose chase. I mean,
exactly.
I have a good insight.
I remember that. I remember when this was Kent's little crazy science project in the garage, and it was like, oh, all right, well, Kent's just working on that silly thing, but whatever, all good.
Yeah, and it was hard to know what some of it. I felt like it was worth understanding. I felt like perhaps given my, I don't even, you know, it's hard to remove my tax experience or my law experience, but I'm not sure if I hadn't had that experience, I wouldn't be similarly intrigued by it. But in any event, pushing it for, you know, on and off for those couple of years, we finally made some headway really at the perfect time because we had, you know, this was in the summer of 22, as rates were really starting to spike, we were able to make some real headway with six of the deals we owned and start moving them into the program. And, you know, that was huge for our investors. Some of those deals were on floating rate loans, and being able to right size those assets, you know, and increase the value. Some of them were cash out refis, so it was perfect timing. There was no way I could have planned for that, but putting in the time up front and then just having it play out the way it did at the right time was you know, very fortunate for us and our investors. That's kind of how I look at a lot of these things. You know, the opportunities to take advantage of these things are hard to predict. But putting in the time up front to understand it so we're mobilized to be able to take advantage of them when they do make sense. You know, you can't, it's very difficult to do it the other way around.
Right. Because a lot of people, once they found themselves in a difficult situation, perhaps, and all of a sudden they're going at the very last minute, at the 11th hour, they're going, oh, well, who's the consultant that will just magically fix my property and whatever it is? It's like, it doesn't work that way.
Well, I think it just goes back to what I said earlier, which is the concept of seeing around a corner, right? So you guys were both able to see around this corner and, you know, and I'm sure there's a lot of other, you know, secrets and other baby or passion projects, I say, that you guys are cooking on currently that, you know, I'm not even aware of, but I'm sure you're thinking about, you know, 10 steps ahead, you know, life's a chessboard and seemingly, you know, you two, which I really respect and why I left my career was because I saw you guys play chess, you know, the game of real estate is chess and you're playing it at a very high level, seeing around the corner, seeing the next move, hedging in the certain directions to set us up for success. And similarly to that vein and to that point, summer of 2020, you were at my house in Oregon and he said, hey, Craig, you know, these deals, because I obviously invested a nice sum of my net worth into our opportunities so I could be eating what we were cooking, of course, to make sure that I was fully vested into the firm naturally. But you're like, don't want to get you too excited, but I do think there's actually this little program that might make us, you know, a little bit of money and also could be really, really helpful for the public benefit, but, you know, kind of will make us look really, really good. And I had really no idea contextually what that meant, but it certainly has been very, very fortunate on timing and also for the firm for us to be able to navigate this. And of course, most importantly, to provide solid public benefit and be a very good partner to the housing authorities that we're, you know, accomplishing these partnerships with.
Yeah. Absolutely. And yes, you're right. We're always cooking up some things in the background. And, you know, I think, yeah, that's always exciting things. And I wish we could share more all the time. But, you know, in time, we'll be able to share more and more of the things that we're working on. But yeah, there's been a lot of fun kind of, they're not side projects because they're just small things that give us a little bit more edge. And multifamily, frankly, is a competitive business. And there's a lot of people doing what we do. And also people can view us as a commodity, right? How many sponsors are out there pitching a multifamily value add deal that's an 80s vintage deal and it's a 16 IRR? So it can be hard to differentiate yourself. And it would take a lot of peeling back the curtain to show, okay, well, actually, this is how we do this. And this is what we're working on here. And you know, we brought property management in-house, and that was something that was very innovative for a firm of our size to do. Not a lot of firms that at the time had 800 units, and we brought property management in-house really early. So I think those are just more examples of kind of the seeing around the corner thing and willing to kind of look around at the market and say, well, can we do something a little bit different? And one more point I'll just add is, you know, at the time that Kent was taking the time to analyze these structures and all that was the time that a lot of people were just buying indiscriminately, right? A lot of equity was available and easy to raise, and they were just putting out money and buying a ton of deals. But were those necessarily great deals? Not necessarily. So, you know, I'm not trying to toot our horn too much here, but we've always wanted to kind of think through things a bit more and think, okay, well, how do we actually buy a deal? Not just buy a property, but buy a good deal. And that requires a little more thought, a little more structuring, and bring something unique to the table.
Well, it's hard to do that when everyone gets drunk on rent growth and interest rates and the market's going gangbusters to stay disciplined and to stay there. But this is also just a PSA to you, the investors or capital allocators out there who are, you know, wanting to just wait, or, you know, let us reach out to, you know, reach out to us, because frankly, and get on our list and get on our good side now, because we have enough equity coming in, or we obviously want to build new relationships. But, you know, to think that we're going to call you first if you haven't, you know, worked with us or built that relationship, you know, before we have this, you know, incredible opportunity, it's just not realistic. So inbound to us, reach out to us beforehand so we can, you know, build the relationship, build the rapport to reach out to you to make sure that you're fit to work with us. So I just want to get that there, that, you know, you're not just going to get that phone call from us saying, hey, we've got a unique situation where we're creating a bunch of alpha, if you haven't been with us before and, you know, had that relationship. So please, you know, go out there and, you know, work on building that relationship and get comfortable with us.
You got to throw out your email.
Of course. Well, it's craig@lscre.com. I know you love hearing it so much on our podcast, so. Yeah. I haven't said it on the show actually in a while. Maybe it's due to the fact that we've had guests. Well, also speaking on, you know, being really thoughtful, because I think kind of the mode of this is being thoughtful, right? Seeing around the corners, playing the game of chess. What I really admire about both of you guys is your vision pertaining to the future and not stuffing your pockets first, but thinking about what actually makes sense to scale appropriately and correctly. So you touched on this, but with the property management and construction management, doing that with 800 units is essentially almost unheard of. So I really admire that you guys treat everyone so well, and I can speak from my experiences. You guys have treated me incredibly. Every employee you've treated incredibly well. Partners, you're very generous in many respects, and I really respect that. But what do you think made you guys see the vision of needing a property management and construction management when most people say, oh, no, just wait till you get to 2,000 or 5,000 units?
I think for me, the main reason we moved forward on that so early was we recognized that there's exposure there. If you're, especially on the value add plans we were doing, the regional manager is probably the most impactful employee at a management company, pushing forward the business plan. And if you have a third-party property management company, that regional could be reassigned. They could take another job at a different firm. And then you're starting over again with the new regional. And that could be really disruptive, especially on those early deals where we were doing bridge loans and trying to get into the refi as quickly as possible. So I think recognizing just not wanting to be in a position we were exposed to that kind of risk really pushed us to find the way to launch Radiance as soon as we did.
Got it. And then construction management, similarly, you just kind of can see, hey, quality control is super important. And that was just kind of the next logical step once you have property management in place.
Essentially, yeah. Having someone in-house to oversee the projects dedicated to that and focused on that really improves the process for everybody.
And there's more than one way to run a management company, and ours is far from perfect. And that's kind of the unfortunate reality about managing workforce housing is it's a thankless, it's a thankless business. You're dealing with tough demographics and tougher properties. So it's not necessarily glamorous, but it is. I'm losing my train of thought because I'm thinking about all the horrors of property management. But it is one of the things I wanted to say is bring in-house, having that control, critical. Similarly, after you bring construction management in-house, we brought in accounting in-house. Right. So we didn't do everything all at once, but just kind of methodically going step by step with the long term vision. Right. And yeah, now I remember what I was going to say. I was going to say about how we were losing money on the property management business at first, probably a decent amount. And then now we're at 4,000 units and we still are pretty much losing money or breaking even on the property management. And that's because we continue to hire in lockstep with the portfolio scale and with the commensurate revenue that comes in. So it affords us to hire a director of construction and to hire regionals and more regionals as we scale in different geographies. So obviously, if you're working with a third-party property management firm, that's not the way they're going to operate, right? They're going to be operating for their profit because they're a for-profit business. That's what their prerogative is. But as managing properties as our subsidiary, you know, we're not managing the properties to make a profit at the management level. We're managing to make a profit at the ownership level.
Exactly. So we can afford to hire more regionals, perhaps per you know, have less, you know, a higher ratio of, or a lower ratio of property to regional than a third-party property management company, which is beneficial. And yeah, we aren't looking to maximize profits at all at the management company.
Yeah, and the way I look at that is it's penny foolish, dollar smart to think of it like that, right? I mean, it's not even penny foolish, but if you want to maximize, you know, other revenue like that, it's penny smart, dollar foolish. But we really want to make sure that the investors get the best experience, you know, a la our operations and systems in place to maximize the investment for the back end profit, not the day to day, you know, keeping lights on profit. So I do have a question for you off topic from this, but pertaining to your background with, you know, starting in your career, which was, you know, working at the IRS. Did you have any lessons that you learned that are applicable today from navigating that kind of world?
I'm not sure. It was a fun experience. It was a useful experience to, I was at the Office of Chief Counsel to the IRS. So they provide legal advice to the IRS in support of, you know, perhaps audits or responding to private letter rulings where people who are taxpayers are able to reach out to the IRS and get a ruling on a question they have. So that was the department I was in, and that was, you know, an invaluable experience to have. It was in Washington, naturally, and, you know, part of me would have even considered staying on there. You know, it was, you know, pretty high level work that we were doing there. Just didn't make sense financially, unfortunately, with what they were able to offer. I still remember, you know, the lifestyle was very good there. I left after 5 one day, and the old lights in the hallway were closed, which means no one had walked in the hallways for, I don't know what the time period was to get those lights off. But, you know, that was an eye-opening experience, you know, seeing how the government works on that side.
That's pretty crazy.
But, you know, it was a good experience to have. You know, I'm happy I went through it, but I'd have to get back to you to think if I had any lessons specifically that applied today.
Well, and then following up to that, but with MetLife and the other group that you're with, PwC you mentioned, what were some of the lessons that you learned there that are applicable to what we're doing in the day-to-day today? Was there any kind of cheat codes or hacks that you got from your time there that was a complementary skill and a building block to what you're doing today?
Yeah, I think working with people is probably the most useful. You know, that's what's jumping to mind right now. Just learning to work with people reporting to you, learning to how to report to your managers above you. It's, you know, very helpful if you can work together to set the priorities and make sure no one's got too much on their plate, or if you have too much on your plate, communicating that to your superiors and just making sure you have the right balance.
You've worked at big companies, and my being a college dropout, I did not spend a lot of time at big companies. And we don't have a big company today, but we're trying to run it like a real company. You know, we're not trying to be super casual and have a few employees. So I think we lean on your experiences working at larger companies to guide us in some fashion as far as, oh, is that normal? Or, you know, what's customary for if this person wants to take a vacation, you know, do we say yes? Or, I mean, it seems like small stuff,
but
Kent and I deal with, if you want to call it HR stuff, all the time, right? Because what is a company? A company is just a collection of people. And the more you progress, the more your company just simply becomes more people. And we're finding, not that it's a bad thing, but more of our time is just spent figuring out how, you know, hire, fire, allocation of human capital and things like that. So I think that's what comes to mind for me, is just leaning on your experience there.
That's fair. You know, I definitely think having that experience does translate to managing people and working. And, you know, like you said, it is everything's people at the end of the day. And that's kind of what I was getting at before, just learning the right way to communicate up and down the chain is very important.
What blueprint, if any, do you guys look up to pertaining to the firm and the growth? Because, you know, as you mentioned, you know, there's not really necessarily a playbook for how to do these things. There's not a, you know, building a real estate syndication empire for dummies book out there, right? Where, you know, at this point you do this, at this point you do that, you know, you put the property management, construction management team in place. So, you know, who do you guys look up to as mentors and as people that, you know, are businesses and groups that you want to emulate?
I think there are a few firms that we've identified as kind of our North Star that we look up to. You know, we have investors that we can learn from. So I think a lot of it, you know, is absorbed by osmosis. And we just are continually, you know, speaking to people who have much more experience than we do, looking at some of these companies that are much further along and, you know, and then playing it by ear and playing it as, you know, playing the field as it comes a little bit. So, you know, I don't know that we certainly don't have a roadmap of where things are. We have some, you know, long-term goals that we have kept in mind, but, you know, for example, bringing accounting in-house, it was the right time for various reasons, and we were able to do that, but we didn't have, you know, way in advance that, you know, in at the start of 2024, that's when we were going to, you know, that's the right time to bring accounting in-house. There were, you know, various factors, but we were evaluating it, you know, and kind of similar to what we said before, being prepared to do it, having an idea of how we would implement it ahead of time was helpful. And then when it made sense, we were able to mobilize and make it happen. But, you know, I don't think we have a blueprint. I think it's just we're continually learning. We're continually exploring, you know, what other companies have done and, you know, then trying to figure out what, you know, what the best way for us to move forward is as we, you know, move from year to year.
I'm going to kick that question over to you.
Yeah, I think, you know, to your point, there is actually, contrary to your point, there is a book on how to build a syndication for dummies. I don't remember what it's called, but Joe Fairless wrote this tome years ago, and it was actually really
good. Best ever real estate syndication book?
Yes, I think that's the one.
It's literally the most simple title, actually.
Yeah, and it's a great book, and it's super comprehensive. It leans more heavily on his expertise, which is more so on the marketing and investor relations side, which is an absolutely critical component of the business. But obviously, if you focus on that, you're missing on all the operational challenges and all the growth and everything that comes along with actually scaling a company to where we're headed, which is, you know, 5,000, 10,000, and I don't know, who knows from there. So yeah, there to some extent, there is a playbook out there, and it's not like we're the first company ever to own 4,000 apartment units, right? There's been many companies like us before, and there'll be many companies like us after. So I think it's there are some kind of well-established playbooks, but are those necessarily the best, right? That's up to us to intuit for ourselves or look at someone and go, is that how we want our company to look? And for us, as you know, and many people know, our driving mantra is we want our investors to sleep well at night. We don't want the biggest business. We want the smoothest business, right? We don't want to be the biggest. We want to be the best. Those are some of the mantras that we throw around. And that has always been something that we've aligned on. You know, we don't have a disagreement on ambition even. Like, as you could imagine, perhaps I could be the younger founder who says, we need to be a $1 billion company, let's go to the moon. And, you know, maybe Kent is, you know, saying, hey, slow down there. No, it's not like that. We're equally perfectly in line with our ambition and our growth, albeit I definitely want to go a little faster, right? And so that's a good balance, I would say, where I'm pushing on the innovation side, saying, let's bring management in-house right now. Let's bring accounting in-house right now. And obviously Kent has to take a second and say, well, you know, we need to think through X, Y, and Z and so on and so forth before we do that. But I think we're really fortunate to align super well on the goals and ambitions of the company, but then at the same time, be very disparate in our skill sets and where we sit. And in particular, on kind of being front-facing, you know, something I think about a lot is I have friends who have started companies with co-founders, and there's a constant battle for ego and recognition.
Yeah, I mean, I can appreciate that. And also, it's really not easy to run a company. People want to be the big boss and want all the smoke. But what comes with that is hiring, firing, the decision makings, the weight of all of that, raising millions of dollars. This is not a, you know, dollar business where you're selling a little widget. This is a big boy complex business where people want to eat your lunch. And it's player versus player to a certain extent. Although it is collaborative and everyone can make money through a transaction process, everyone wants your secret and informations and, you know, wants to go after you and to have a little bit of a competitive edge. So it's very cool that we're all in this ecosystem together to create that with one another, for sure. But you did forget one mantra that we go by, which is doing smart things with smart people, which you both are obviously two of the most intelligent people. And that's why I left my personal career of residential real estate to, you know, ultimately pursue something that was greater than myself and something that had a longer and greater tarmac to the future, which was for me a big deal because I, you know, stepped down in many respects. And yeah, I went from this perfect situation where I was making, you know, very nice money with no boss, you know, making my own hours, although I, you know, worked all the time, but making my own hours, you know, didn't have anyone to adhere to. And here we are now where I have two bosses that I basically effectively report to, but I wouldn't really want to have it any other way. And I know my growth has been substantially enhanced due to both of you people. So I'm very grateful for that. So thank you. Segueing to a question that I had, which was, early on, how did you both know how to divide and conquer tasks and roles with your complementary skill sets? Was it implied? Was it kind of just, you know, ad hoc by any means, or whatever it takes? You know, how do you guys both see that? I'd be curious to know both of your perspectives.
So I think it was ad hoc, you know, all hands on deck at first, but then we naturally found, you know, the better, you know, the more appropriate responsibilities for each of us to handle, you know, kind of leaned in from there. So obviously you started with underwriting. And then, you know, I think we both recognized early on your ability to raise capital. So that kind of, and I was more focused on everything being buttoned and making sure we were tracking the financials properly. So that kind of just continued throughout where, you know, I'm overseeing operations and that side of the house, the back house, so to speak, and Rob is front and center, but also doing the underwriting as well, or at least overseeing it.
Yeah. I mean, it really broke out very nicely. I would say that you have a little bit too much responsibility, right? You've got a lot going on. You're responsible for a ton of stuff, but that's because, well, I mean, it's because you're capable and that's just how things are. But it started because asset management, when you have no properties, is not a job. And then you have one property, asset management is overseeing one asset, right? But you go from one to 20. Now all of a sudden that could take all your time and more. So that's, you know, your role has really ballooned, in my opinion, to just be more and more responsibility. And I think something that I want us to work toward is just building out the org chart and having more support on the asset management, property management, operations side, which we're taking steps to do. And it's something that Craig and I talk a lot about, which is the unfortunate nonlinear scalability of the management side, right? With every unit that you add, that's just more human capital that you have to address and put to work to the matter. So whereas on our side of the business, we're very fortunate on acquisitions and on capital markets, specifically raising debt and raising equity, you can add zeros and the numbers can get bigger and you can do more and it doesn't really take that much more manpower. So we're really fortunate on the acquisition side and on the raising capital side. I mean, we're very fortunate to not have the acquisition side have to scale and we don't have to hire a ton of analysts to crunch a ton of numbers, right? We can scale on the acquisition side by increasing the deal size that we're doing, right? To accomplish our goals rather than increasing necessarily the number of deals that we're acquiring and underwriting. But anyway, I digress. So point is, yeah, we are taking steps as necessary to really grow out and institutionalize. I think that's kind of the next big thing for Lone Star is, you know, yes, we've bought deals. Yes, the deals have gotten bigger. We've successfully closed a $100 million transaction. So I think that's just putting one foot in front of the other. But the next big leap forward is really institutionalizing the operations.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's our focus for this year. We're really working to kind of rebuild that foundation to allow us to do, you know, asset manage effectively, you know, 10,000, 20,000 units, whatever it may be, but really rebuild that foundation with the institutional mindset and provide some scalability there, meaning trying to figure out ways to be smarter with automation and have the data at our fingertips that will allow us to get our reports out quicker and with less manual work, which should help in that regard as well.
I have something I'm very curious to ask, which is what from your perspectives, and I would need both of you guys to answer this, what from both of your perspectives was the hardest part about starting the firm, you know, about 6 years ago? I'd be curious because it's going to be probably different answers. So the floor is yours.
I mean, the hardest part was just getting the deals done originally, raising the money we needed to get our first deal done and our second deal done was very difficult. We didn't have a track record. We had to, you know, and, you know, failure wasn't an option. We just didn't stop, but it was not a simple path forward. We perhaps a bit too optimistic about the ability to raise money. You know, if before you have a deal, you ask people if they're interested in investing. It's like, oh yeah, I'd love to invest. Once you bring them a deal, the tune changes, as I'm sure you've seen. So, you know, we thought, and I had brought some money to some of those deals before we had met that I had partnered on. So yeah, I think we thought it would be easier than it actually was. And it was a lot harder than I think either of us anticipated. So working through, you know, that was eye-opening, was a bit frightening. But when your back's up against the wall, you really find a way to get over that line and get through it. And then there's no looking back.
Yeah, putting your back against the wall is a cheat code in many respects, right? If you're desirous of accomplishing something really big, just as they say, putting your back against the wall or burning your boats is not fun, but it is very effective. I mean, it obviously lit a fire under us because you can't even call it motivation, because how are you, it's not motivation, it's just life or death. Like, that's how we felt.
It's whatever it takes.
It's just whatever it takes, right? So of course I'm going to get up and call every single person I know and ask them for money, right? That was a humbling, tough, tough experience. And for me, the phone can weigh 800 pounds often. I don't want to call people and talk to people. Yeah, I know you'd have a hard time talking on the phone.
It took you a long time to be willing to meet people in person even.
Totally.
If you remember.
It was not, I mean, now today it's very straightforward for us to look at our partnership and go, oh, well, that makes sense. Rob's the guy that is on the Zoom calls all the time and he's the one that's doing the videos and the webinars, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, you're on the back of house, but that wasn't the original vision, right? Both of us came into the business with this idea that marketing is not something that we're interested in. And we didn't want to necessarily do investor relations or market ourselves and things like that. Neither of us wanted that, but do or die, right? Out of necessity, I stepped up and I'm very thankful that I did. And everything's worked out really well. But yeah, it was not a natural thing for us. So it was a very tough learning experience, very difficult. That was the hardest part. I really feel like at the beginning of the business, and why should it be any different? It just felt like we were going from one crisis to the next. And I know you feel that in a big way. It's just like one insurmountable existential thing to deal with to the next. And it was with every hurdle that we overcame, I feel like we just added more, I don't know, strength to our armor and built up our confidence. So now when we encounter an issue, it's of course stressful, but I feel like we have this element of, oh, we've been there before and we'll get through it again.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I think we view challenges a whole lot differently now. We expect to find a way to get to the other side, and because we've done it so many times, and we're able to get there quicker because we're not as nervous about it, and we're confident there will be a way.
So how about this? Our first ever capital raise was $4.4 million, right? That was very tough, and raising $4.4 million, no matter who you are, is a great accomplishment. That's not easy to do. But nowadays, you'll check in with us because obviously you delegate the raise and responsibility, right? And you'll check in with us and you go, so how's the raise going? And we'll say, oh, well, we've got about $4.4 million left. And you go, oh, so that's nothing. That's not much. You're almost there, right? So it's amazing how that used to be an unthinkable thing to do. And now it's just kind of, hey, par for the course, you have to get this done and keep it moving.
Yeah, well, divide and conquer, as I mentioned before. You know, it's funny, when we're in a room together at a conference, I'm a little bit more, I would say, outgoing if I'm just going to go up to talk to someone, probably. But if it came to a stage, I would be you know, pooping my pants, probably, to be honest, if I had to give a public talk. But I will go up to anyone, I will talk to a brick wall and have a good conversation. Similarly, I would say, not that you won't have a lovely conversation, but it's just really not what you're into. I think you're more of an introvert than an extrovert, believe it or not. However, you get on the stage, you know, I think you've said this before, you basically feel like you're talking to no one because the room's so full, which is slightly counterintuitive in many respects.
I think many introverts actually find themselves comfortable on stage because, yeah, you're not having a conversation. You're doing a performance, which is also maybe somewhat of a sociopathic thing to say. Yeah, well, but I truly think that Kent actually enjoys conversation more than I do, which doesn't really make sense. But I think you kind of, when you get comfortable and you're at a conference, like I see Kent, you know, he's at a conference, kick back, looking cool, chatting.
I prefer one-to-one conversations for sure, or one to few. I definitely don't like being on camera. I don't like giving speeches. I don't like doing webinars. Something about that just doesn't work for me. But yeah, you know, one to few, I'm very comfortable with that.
I'd be curious to know, on both your ends as well, on that theme of, you know, hearing both perspectives, it's, what's been the most rewarding part of the journey to this point?
Seeing what we've been able to build and looking back kind of at our starting point and thinking back to, you know, those early challenges and looking now to where we've overcome them, and we still see a lot of growth and you know, progress over the coming years. You know, I think building a business is rewarding, you know, building a team that we like coming to work with every day. It's incredibly satisfying.
Yeah, it's really, really cool to hear. It's true. The juxtaposition looking back is really surreal and rewarding. And it's kind of like what some rich people say, which is the coolest part about being rich is thinking back to when you were poor, right? And thinking back to how, because I mean, not that I could imagine if you were born wealthy, right? Then what's the joy in it? You just always had it. But, you know, we didn't have this company, right? It didn't exist before. And then you and I walk around the office and it's, you hear someone say, you know, hi, this is Craig with Lone Star Capital, right? And it's like, oh, that's cool.
That might be it. Yeah. Hearing that call.
Right.
Well, it's even crazy on my end to hear people say yes so quickly. And also, I, for one way or another, saw it from the ground floor, because I remember I've told the story several times, but I'll tell it once more on air with you both, was I remember in 2018, we were at the Rosewood, maybe it was 2017, and I think you texted, hey, like I'm out and about, and here 20 or 21-year-old, he may not even be able to legally drink at that point, but we're at in the Rosewood, which is a very known establishment in the Menlo Park area, and there he was, pinstripe suit, white shirt, red tie, you know, in the typical Rob Beardsley fashion. This is not something that, you know, got forced upon you. This is something that was in your blood and DNA, seemingly, that you wanted that, you know, professional look. So to see that, you know, you've incorporated that, you've kept it, you've maintained it, and then you've basically, you know, you go into our office and everyone's suit and tie, and that's the culture we have. So you've built, you know, both of you gentlemen have built a legitimate, bona fide culture and firm that is, you know, really at this point, a very well-oiled machine where I can call people and I can raise money in our ecosystem without either of you being attached in the process. You know, I think one thing that was kind of crazy to me to think about was when we had a lot of those conversations with those investors for the Dream Investor interview. And I don't think either of you spoke to like a good, healthy amount of those people, which is nuts to think that you guys have trained and created an ecosystem where it can all kind of fall into place without the need of either of you to be there to answer these questions.
Yeah, going back to puzzles and building a mousetrap, that is incredibly rewarding, because I think something that is the opposite of rewarding but actually suffocating is the idea of building something that really is just a trap. And that's what most small business owners find themselves in, is they've built themselves a high-paying trap. It's not really a business. It's just a job they've built for themselves. And the second that they take their eye off the ball, things start falling apart and they're scrambling. And I'm not saying we're there yet, but I think that's the puzzle. And the most rewarding thing is to know that in certain elements of the business, if we were to remove ourselves, maybe temporarily, maybe permanently, eventually, not to say that that's what we want, but it's just, I guess that's kind of the funny thing, is the proper goal of a true business owner, or they say the mark of a quality CEO, is that the company does better when they leave, right? And that's absolutely the way I think about things. I want to build a mousetrap and a perfectly well-oiled machine that can run without us. But at the same time, it's not like we want to do nothing. So it's kind of a paradox in the way. But yeah, that's the most rewarding thing, is to see, oh, wow, you know, you did the webinar and you put the pitch deck together, and then you underwrote the deal. You put the bid in and you won the deal for us, and all these things that I used to do step by step, all completely on my own. Now it's being done without me.
How have you been able to manage and delegate? Because you're really good at that, almost overly trusting, I would say, to think people are competent enough one way or another. I remember like, hey, here it is. I'm like, I don't really know what I'm doing, but you know, walked me through it. You're very patient. You're a very patient person. You held my hand. But do you think that is just innate in your DNA, that you are just really good at delegating and are comfortable? Or do you just hire correctly, you think, on the front end, where you kind of know what people have in them just from an instinctual perspective, you know, within your gut?
I think it's a combination of all those things. I think we're very passionate about hiring A players. I think that's just, it just makes way too much sense to not hire A players. And that affords you the luxury of being more liberal with your delegation. I think there's another element of having a culture of being willing to fail. You know, I wouldn't want to have a work environment where people are scared to fail and they feel like, you know, they don't want to take on more responsibility for fear of failure because they feel like they'll be reprimanded or something like that, right? So everyone knows that if they can't do something, they can just come to one of us or someone at the firm and get help. So that is another strong tool to be able to strengthen your delegation. So yeah, hiring A players, having a culture where people aren't afraid to fail, and then, like you said, patience. That patience is definitely an innate thing. You know, going back to when I worked with special needs students in school, when I was a piano teacher, when I was a math tutor, I was always patient with that. So I think it's the same thing here.
Well, it's interesting that you're both patient, because there's a lot of very intelligent, you know, if you took IQ tests, you gentlemen are both probably higher than, you know, the average percentile of individuals, most definitely. But a lot of very, very smart people are terrible with people, which is a really unique blend that you guys have to, you know, have the sophistication to do really complex, nuanced things while also being very patient and gracious with your time and not, you know, annoying or not getting annoyed by, you know, people who maybe just are a little bit slower like me. You know, I need a little more time with things. It takes me a little bit longer to understand some concepts, but when I have it, I have it.
I think it's also knowing people's limits or knowing where they are, right? So having empathy, because it's communication and empathy. You're going to be frustrated with someone if they don't do what you want them to do. But at the end of the day, it's your fault because you didn't communicate, most likely, what you wanted them to do. So it's communication and then knowing where that person is in their, you know, the things that I'm having you do now, I didn't have you do a year ago, right? And you know today why, right? It's not like I didn't have that thing to give you back then. It's just, I knew in my head, that's probably not a wise thing to do, right? So it's knowing how to do that and having that right balance, because we do want people to reach up. The best things you can do for someone often is to hire or promote them into a position that they're not ready for, because it just forces growth, just like how our back was against the wall. And hey, you have to raise money. So it's a similar concept there.
That said, you know, final kind of thought I want to have here. We've, you know, held you hostage in this room for longer than you probably were anticipated or wanted. So thank you so much for being so gracious and coming on the podcast. You know, we thought maybe episode 100 or 50 you'd come on, but thankfully came in before the first year wrapped up of this show. But with that said, is there any other grand vision or futures that you have for the firm, both of you guys? You know, obviously our goal this year was to be ambitious and acquire $300 million of assets, but, you know, at a more holistic overarching view, you know, multiple states, we obviously are, of course, Lone Star Capital. We're only in Texas, Houston, Dallas, and San Antonio. But, you know, long-term, where do you see the firm going? And what would you like to do that we aren't doing today in the future?
I think we touched on a lot of that already. I think we want to a lot more of the same, but we want to level up. We want to institutionalize our asset management. We do want to do more deals and bigger deals and you know, our annual acquisition target's a bit higher than it is this year. But, you know, we're not looking to be the biggest. So, you know, I think, you know, looking a few years out, if we can hit, you know, a goal maybe a little bit further than we are, you know, on this year, and do that you know, repeatedly with larger deals and perhaps fewer deals per year, but just larger acquisitions, you know, that would probably be the goal, and kind of rinse and repeat. Eventually we'll have more exits, you know, every year along with the acquisitions. And, you know, I think we both are in alignment and, you know, that being a very, very comfortable landing point. And does it evolve from there? Sure. Do we look in other markets at some point? Probably. But, you know, I think that's the overall vision.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And then, of course, to make things interesting, we're, you know, always cooking up some other stuff, right? So you never know what project people ask us, are you going to get into development? You know, who knows? But there's always things that are going to be pulling on you. And I think that is perhaps a skill or just a discipline in itself to be able to say no. I think that's actually a big part of our success, is that we don't just run after every shiny idea. We've stick to our knitting. We've, like you said, we've done our Texas multifamily acquisitions. We haven't done development. We haven't branched out of the state. And that's just rinse and repeat. A lot of people would either get bored of that or feel like they need to do something smarter and more innovative and something like that. But, you know, we have this contentment to just put one foot in front of the other and keep doing that. And then when something truly compelling comes around, we can actually make that strategic decision, right? It took us a long time to go from being a Houston multifamily owner to deciding to be a Houston and a Dallas multifamily owner. And then we also took time and were patient in making the decision to expand into San Antonio. So I think that's really important. I really think about, you know, my life is not necessarily simple, but I think about wanting to have the simplest life, which doesn't sound ambitious, but it's a lot of work to build a simple life, right? And a simple business, because it's kind of like, you know, maybe Occam's razor a little bit, but it's the most, like, if I had more time, I would have written you a shorter email kind of thing.
Well, I think about this, which is the concept of, if you want to have an easier life, you got to have a harder life today. And if you want to have a harder life tomorrow, have an easier life today. Awesome. Well, with that said, thank you so much for tuning into this episode, the first of many with the two founders of Lone Star Capital. No, I am not a founder. These are the founders right here. But thank you so much for listening to the show, for being here, and we look forward to seeing you next week.